Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Back to school season is as good a time as any to get back into the swing of things, get healthy, and stay that way. Looking for a little advice or motivation? There's the University of California Berkeley's Wellness Letter online. It's got a little bit of everything: weight loss, heart health, sleep, and nutrition, to name a few. UC Berkeley is home to the School of Public Health, one of the best in the country. And joining us again today is the chair of the editorial board for the Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg, to talk about the medical issues of the day and what you need to know. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you so much for asking me.
First of all, you have a new wellness letter out there. It's called Eating for Optimal Health. And I was wondering why you decided to break out the eating and nutrition piece of good health from the existing wellness letter.
Well, what we've had a lot of requests from readers to sort of put together key points from a lot of the wellness letters in the recent past. And so we're doing supplements now a couple times a year. And the first supplement that we've done was this Eating for Optimal Health, because we get so many questions about it.
What other supplements are you looking at?
Oh, no, not so much supplements. That's just, these are supplements to the wellness letter.
No, I know. What other topics would be supplements then besides?
Well, we actually have one coming out in the spring on supplements.
Okay.
And we have one coming out on cholesterol.
Okay.
So those seem to be hot topics right now.
Well, speaking of diet, there is all this talk about gluten-free diets, and not just for people who have celiac disease, but everybody. The headline on the August wellness letter is Wheatophobia. Will avoiding wheat really improve your health?
You know, it's so interesting, Ann, because every year or two there's a new fad in medicine, sometimes triggered by books like this was, or sometimes triggered by other things in the media. And right now there's a big fad on wheat being bad for you. And a lot of this was prompted by a book that was published, within the last couple years, called Lose Weight and Lose the Weight and Find Your Path Back to Health. And the book's title was Wheat Belly. And it suggested that wheat is really just terrible for you. It can, as a matter of fact, there's a quote from the book saying it can harm you more than any foreign terrorist can inflict on us. So wheat's become an enemy, at least in the minds of quite a few people.
So when they make those claims, actually you're talking about William Davis, the cardiologist and author of The Wheat Belly.
Right.
You're saying that some of his points, I think a subhead is called Kernels of Half Truth.
Right.
So they're coming from something.
They are, and you know, most things come from something. It's not like it's just pulled out of the air. And there are quite a few things in the book that are very accurate. It's really the impression, and actually the frank statement that wheat is harmful to so many people that there's not really good scientific support for that. But there are some claims or kernels of half truths in there. Absolutely.
And to what extent does the biologically engineered wheat, not just wheat, but any of the grains now that are staples in our diet, how does that have an impact on anything?
Well, that sure is one of the claims that it's having a major impact. And it prompted us to take a very careful look at the scientific literature, going back through a good part of the 20th century on the claims that were made in the book that this genetically engineered wheat has things in it that wheat previously didn't have, and this is harming us. And we could not find any good science to support that statement at all.
But no question that if I have one slice instead of two slices of toast in the morning with my eggs, I'm probably better off.
Well, you know, people do lose weight when they go on this diet. As a matter of fact, people lose weight when they go on any kind of diet. And the reason why people have lost weight on the diet that is suggested in this book is because it changes the way you eat. For exactly the reason you mentioned, if the book says don't eat a lot of wheat and so therefore you can't have any bread, if you eliminate most breads from your diet, even for a short while, you're going to lose some weight. It just alters the way we eat. The problem is that if you look long term, there's no evidence that any of these kinds of diets really sustain weight loss, which is what we're all after.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. If you have any questions about health, they pretty much cover the gamut in their wellness letters. It's kind of amazing, Dr. Swartzberg. Anyways, if anyone wants to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can use our Facebook page, and you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. We've talked about it before, but it bears repeating how you decide what goes into the wellness letters from one month to the next.
Right. Well, I think there's several ways. The most common way is emails or letters from our readers asking questions, and we get a good sense of what's going on there and what questions they'd like answered. We also every day look at what's happening in the news of health and wellness, and so we get a lot of ideas from that. And then finally, I read tons of journals, as do many other members of our editorial board, and we get a lot of ideas from that. So putting all those together and mixing them together, that's really where we come up with the themes. We also, like what we were just talking about with Wheat Belly, we look at what are some of the fads that seem to be out there right now and address those and try and look for the science behind them.
Leaving the subject of food for a second, in the last two editions, last two newsletters, you've talked about sun. About a healthy tan, and the other one is about something new under the sun. We have new labeling, which I did not notice this summer.
Right. Well, we're going to be getting new labeling probably by December. Sort of as an aside, it's worth people knowing that there's been a push to get new labeling on sunscreens for a long, long time, and it's finally going to happen. There was obviously a lot of pushback to doing that by the manufacturers, but it is. I have to smile a little bit that. The agreement finally was that the labeling would come out in December when
right.
No one's particularly concerned about the sun.
Unless you're lucky enough to go away someplace warm. But,
right. Yeah. Right. So anyway, the new labeling is I think, good. It's not perfect, and certainly we'll squabble about some things with the new labeling, but it makes it a little clearer. The old SPF kind of idea that more is better, and so people were advertising 50% or SPF of 50, SPF of 60, SPF of 100, mm-hmm. and it sounded like, wow, if it's 100, it's got to be twice as good as 50, where it's only a fraction of a percent better because it's on a logarithmic scale. Mm. And so there was really... it was purely a marketing ploy and had nothing to do with protection. So the new regulations are going to allow people to say 50 plus and nothing more than that. I think that's helpful. I think some of the other important things are that it's going to get rid of the idea of sunscreen being waterproof. There's nothing you can put on your skin that's going to be waterproof. So there'll be things that will suggest that If it may be more stable with water, but you still have to apply it and reapply it at least every couple hours if you've been in the water. So I think that will be helpful to consumers. This water-resistant idea is really important to move away from that because it does mislead people. Some of the other things are that another, I think, important word that's going to be removed, or two words, is sunblock. There's no such thing as anything we can put on our skin to completely block the UVA and UVB, the important
even rays the white from stuff the sun. You put on your nose. You see people sometimes with a white cream on their nose, even that.
Yeah, that's the nitrous oxide, yeah. And it's really good. I mean, it does block a lot of the UVA and UVB, but it doesn't completely do it. And so that's going to be removed because we don't want people to think that if they put that on, they can just bask out in the sun and not have to worry about the consequences of that. And I think the consequences are that from a public health perspective, that's what this is all about. It's not about deceptive labeling. It's really about the consequences. And I think the two big things, of course, the biggest is skin cancer, including the deadly skin cancer, melanoma. And then the other is what I often found with my patients was really helpful in getting them to use sunscreen, and that was that it ages your skin. And that's important for people to recognize, that sun really makes people look old much more quickly than they want to.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the University of California Berkeley's Wellness Center, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The world really is your oyster. There's just a little bit of everything in these wellness letters. For instance, hypnosis. And I would love to be hypnotized to get rid of my sweet tooth. Any hope for that?
Well, you can try it.
But you're not poo-pooing hypnosis per se. You're saying, yeah, there really is a thing called hypnosis, and it really does happen to some
right.
people.
Right. There is a thing called hypnotherapy or hypnosis. There's I don't think there's really a controversy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually is some science behind a lot of the claims, or at least some of the claims made. We found some articles that looked at pain management. For example, people with headaches or burns, arthritis, or backaches. For some phobias, there was some science behind that. There was a real interesting paper, albeit just one from Canada, on people with irritable bowel syndrome. So there have been a variety of things, claims about smoking cessation and menopausal symptoms and weight loss. I didn't see anything, Anne, about a sweet tooth, though. The problem is that, as I'm sure that your listeners understand, it's very hard to do a double-blinded control study. As a matter of fact, it's essentially impossible to do a double-blinded control study, which is really the gold standard to see what's happening. And so the question is, what is happening in this, quote, hypnotic state? Is it just that it makes people believe? Is it a placebo effect? Or is there something more there? And the answer is there probably is something more there, but it's real hard to know how important that is or how powerful it is. What I think I sort of personally liked about the idea was that it appears to be completely safe. You can't be hypnotized against your will. You know, like in the movies, we've seen people being hypnotized to do some heinous things.
Mm-hmm.
That can't happen. If you don't want to be hypnotized, you're not going to be hypnotized. So it's not like you have to worry about that. And if it could help, for example, in post-operative pain management or people with chronic pain problems like backaches and so on, it would be a perfectly safe thing to try. I just think your listeners have to know that this is something they can try. There's not a lot of great science behind it, but it certainly is safe.
And if somebody does want to try it, you have some recommendations for where they
we
should
really
go?
We really do. I mean, there are a lot of people who make a lot of claims, like with everything, and you have to be really careful who you see. There's actually a Society of Hypnosis, and you can find that online, or there's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, and these are people who are certified and trained in how to do this. You can also find it through a variety of medical societies or talking to colleagues if you have some that might know people. But be careful not just to go to somebody who's just making claims.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California Berkeley's Wellness Letter. If you have any questions or comments for him about your health, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Neil Conan. Every day brings fresh developments and interesting stories to tell. At Talk of the Nation, we look for the stories that matter to you. From international news to the latest campaign politics to the issues that touch your family, tune in for Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 75 degrees with partly sunny skies will reach a high of 85 today. A few clouds tonight and a low of 60. Support for 89.7 comes from BeDry Waterproofing, with a patented system that stops groundwater from entering a home's foundation, protecting more than 250,000 homeowners since 1958. More information at 1-800-563-BeDry or BeDry.com. And support comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movements in our community. More information on the fall edition, coming September 15th, can be found at ediblecolumbus.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And what are we talking about, you might ask? We're talking about health in general. If you have any health-related questions, medical, nutrition or otherwise, give us a call. You can email us, and you can go to our our Facebook page as well and post your question or comment there. There is a featured article in your most recent issue about antioxidants. They attack free radicals, which can cause cancer, etc. And the article calls antioxidants overrated. Why? And first of all, what are some antioxidants that are really popular out there now?
Well, the big popular ones in terms of supplements are vitamin C, vitamin E. So those are extremely popular. And then there's so many in different kinds of foods. So you essentially can see that antioxidant label just about anywhere you go in terms of claims made about this is healthy because it's got antioxidants in it. We just don't think that's true. And I think it's really, as our title said, it's really overrated. Now, I probably should explain that a little bit. Antioxidants are a way our body takes care of potentially damaging chemicals that are made as we, quote, burn oxygen to use for energy. And they're critical in terms of our body's functioning. So antioxidants are necessary, really, for our cells to function and therefore life. So there's no question that antioxidants are key. The question is, do you have to take supplemental antioxidants, or if a little is good, is more better? And I think that's where one really needs to draw the line.
Also, let's go to Kim in Columbus first. Hi, Kim, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you both for taking my call. I'll try to make it succinct. My daughter has some issues apparently with metabolizing the grains, yeast, things that have yeast in them, or fungus like peanuts, and it shows itself as canker sores in the mouth, but more recently in the labia area. Any thought or knowledge about a connection there?
That's really an interesting question. It's very difficult for me to see a connection between the foods that you mentioned or yeasts or fungi in general that you might be consuming and triggering these phenomena. Now, that said, when you mentioned canker sores, it's so interesting that we don't really know what causes canker sores.
Right.
Something that all of us experience, and unfortunately often many times and very uncomfortable, and we're not sure what the cause is of that. So I wasn't quite clear on how to associate these things, but then when you said that there are also similar sores, blister-like sores on the labia, that really makes me wonder whether she is kind of having some kind of reaction. I don't know whether it would be to yeast. Let me come back to that yeast question in just a second. Here's what I would suggest: that she see a dermatologist, And if the dermatologist doesn't have any ideas what may be going on, then I would suggest a person who specializes in rheumatology, that is autoimmune disorders. I think that would be the way I would go.
Okay.
But let me come back to the yeast thing in a more generic way for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in the show, Ann and I were talking about fads in medicine mm-hmm. and wellness. And yeast has been around for probably about 30 years in terms of people thinking that they're having terrible reactions to yeast and that it's causing all sorts of horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of people who write about this, not good scientists, but a lot of people who write about this without any good science behind it. The claims made for this in general are at best hyperbole and at worst just not true. So I'd be careful to blame things on the yeast, and I think that's the direction I would pursue it with your daughter.
Okay, well, thank you, and that is a good clue, and I just, I probably should have told you this first. She's 22 now. We started at 3 with a homeopath, and over the years where a parent can control a kid's diet, using rice-based breads, yogurt, cheeses, etc., seem to reduce or eliminate the occurrence of the sores in her mouth.
Well, you know, I applaud you for doing what you're doing to try and help her, and it sounds like maybe that is. I would just want to make sure that that's correct, in the sense that I'd hate to see her spending her life thinking that there's certain foods she just can't eat when she really could. And it may very well be the case. But I think one good, thorough evaluation to make sure we're not missing anything is worthwhile.
Thanks, Kim. Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sometimes I get canker sores that are so bad that they give me a lisp. And, you know, which is not great in my line of business. But I've always thought it must have something to do with what I'm eating. But by the time I see my dermatologist or see a doctor, I don't have it. So I don't ask about it. So we don't really know, though.
We don't know the cause of it. People have speculated that it's a viral infection that keeps reactivating. And that's probably the best hypothesis for the etiology. But no organism has been, at least to date, isolated. That said, there are a variety of things that can be put on canker sores that can shorten their duration and severity. And yes, somebody in your line of work, you might want to pursue that. either a dermatologist or a ear, nose, and throat specialist could advise you on some of those things that you can put on the canker sores.
Something you could just have on hand, because
exactly.
Who knows when they're going to pop
exactly.
up, right?
Right.
Okay. Junior in Circleville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Junior.
Thank you for taking my phone call.
You're welcome.
Well, I have an issue where I have these fat tumors or lipomas that occur. They just kind of appear and then disappear over time. And sometimes I can get a little sore in certain places, mostly around my midsection, you know, throughout my kind of my torso area. And some of them are, you know, a little small, and those can get bigger, but I just wonder, is there anything I've talked to doctors about? They always just kind of like, well, we don't think there's anything important to think about when it comes to these things. I'm just wondering if you have any insight on these lipomas.
Sure. Well, the first question I would have is to be sure they're lipomas. Lipomas are benign fatty tumors. They tend to
right.
run in families. They're really common. And the reason why I want you to be sure is because lipomas tend to grow and then reach a certain size and just sit there and don't do anything. They don't
right.
tend to get better. And that's a little unusual when you're talking about lipomas. They also don't tend to get sore or red.
Right. Well, mine don't get red ever. What happens is that I'll have one, like I've had one that was like on the middle of the, kind of off to my side, where like the love handles are, would be on a person. And so I had one that was kind of biggish, and it just was a little bit sore, just to kind of like the way I bend. It was kind of a spot
mm-hmm.
you bend a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a little bit tender, and then all of a sudden I had it for a few months, and all of a sudden it just goes away. It's just not there anymore. But every time I talk to a doctor about it, they kind of move it around, they kind of get the feel for it, and they say, well, it has all the characteristics of a lymphoma. And I got them on other places in my body, and I know my grandfather had them, I know my father has them. So I have all the characteristics of that these are lymphomas. But mine seem to reabsorb and then show up other places and then reabsorb and then show up in other places. So.
Well, I think these really do sound like lipomas. The familial history is classic. The location you're describing is a very characteristic location, and your doctors are correct that these are completely benign. They don't say anything about your general health or your prognosis for a healthy life, and you really shouldn't have them removed because people will just be whittling away at you. I'm just glad that sometimes they do go away because that is unusual. Most people just, as I said, just have them sit there. So I would agree with your doctors that they can tell just by examining you. I think that's reasonable. And nothing really needs to be done or should be done.
By the way, JR, sorry to mispronounce your name. Appreciate the call. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Martin in Sunbury, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could speak about fats in the diet. I've sort of become convinced that the only fats you should eat are animal fats from pastured animals, olive oil, palm oil, and coconut oil. And palm and coconut in particular have had bad raps in various years. But anyhow, I don't eat vegetable oils and only organic of those, and I'm curious what you have to say about that.
Dr. Swartzberg?
Sure. Do you have a couple of hours? Because it's a big topic. What you're getting at with pasteurized are animals that are fed in feed in pastures is that they have less of the marbling that people recognize in meat, and that's less of the saturated fat. So animals that have purely grown on pasture, have less saturated fat in them than animals have been corn-fed. And so in that sense, that meat is healthier or less unhealthy is perhaps a better way to look at it, because saturated fat, it's pretty clear, at least in large quantities, is not a healthy way to eat. In terms of some of the other fats, you're also absolutely right, or at least consistent with the thinking that we've reviewed in the wellness letter about some of the oils that we were told in the past that were bad, like coconut oil, I think you had mentioned. There are saturated fats in coconut oil, but all saturated fats are not the same. And the ones that are most prominent in coconut oil appear to have sort of a neutral effect on us. I think what you're getting at with oils, that is fats from grains, is the omega-6 question. And that's a real complicated question because there's not a lot of good understanding about how good or bad those are. I think all in all, those fats are very healthful. One of the questions that some people have is, are we getting too much omega-6 compared to the, quote, omega-3s that you've probably heard so much about? And is that ratio off? And the fact is, we really don't know. So bottom line, I think the most healthful fats are the ones you get from grains, like, for example, from soy. I think that the monounsaturated fats are very healthful, for example, olive oil. And I think you should minimize in your diet the saturated fats in general, with the caveat that I mentioned about coconut oil.
Martin, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Craig in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Well, hi. I wanted to make a comment about hypnosis. My parents-in-law had smoked for 50 years, well into their 70s. They got themselves hypnotized and never had another desire for another cigarette. Now, my brother had himself hypnotized about weight. No luck whatsoever. Comments?
Yes. I'm really delighted to hear that about your parents. Sorry about your brother-in-law. But there's been a lot of claims about hypnosis for smoking. There's not a lot. We couldn't find any good science to support the claims that were made. Again, that said, it would be a, if it works for you and it gets you to quit smoking, I don't care if it's placebo or not. That's just wonderful. Because, you know, all the things we talk about, smoking is probably the worst. So that's great. So my comment is that that's pretty typical of what we hear about hypnosis in general. Some people appear to be more susceptible or suggestive. Some people appear to take in hypnosis and let it work for them better than others. We just don't understand who they are. There have been, actually, we found some papers that were trying to look at different people's psychology and predict who would be most amenable to hypnosis. And unfortunately, we couldn't come up with a good answer to that one.
Craig, thanks for the call. Take
care. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Bye.
From Sue on Facebook, same topic, so I'll get to it right now. Years ago, I went to a seminar for hypnotherapy to help stop bad habits. I decided I wasn't really ready to give up sweets, so did not follow up with listening to the tapes after the introductory meeting. Nevertheless, and despite my skepticism, I was without any desire to eat junk for about 3 weeks. I tried this after my very skeptical but desperate parents were able to give up smoking via hypnosis. Worth a try. Yet again, another vote for...
worth a try for
smoking. But yeah. I don't think of sugar as junk, Sue. That's my problem. My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. Any questions or comments for him, we welcome them. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet at WOSU All Sides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comic W. Kamau Bell, host of the FX series Totally Biased, which brings an African-American perspective to political comedy. On one of Bell's comedy tours, to attract a multicultural audience, he made this offer.
If you bring a friend of a different race, you get in 2-for-1.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. And when you support 89.7 NPR News at $85, you'll receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining at admission discounts at more than 200 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/member card for more information. And thanks for your membership in 89.7 NPR News. 77 degrees with partly sunny skies, a high near 85 today. Clouds tonight, a low of 60. Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And support comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. We'll post a link to that letter if you're interested in seeing it at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. I'm sorry. Yeah, at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Swartzberg, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Brian in Columbus, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. My question is, I'm 47. I have generalized stomach discomfort, whether on an empty stomach or after I've eaten. Nothing debilitating, but something that I feel like I should address. And I'm wondering what the best path is to follow to have testing done for that, or should I go straight to the scope and have them look at the stomach lining itself?
Right. Great question. I think, like with any problem, start general and then work specific. By that I mean I would see your physician and have a complete careful history taken, because there's so many things that can cause stomach distress. When we're having problems with our intestines and our stomach, there are very few ways that they can tell us there's a problem. And so many different things can cause the same symptomatology. So a very careful history is critical. And after that, a careful examination of your abdomen and some routine laboratory work. All that can be done by your family physician. If nothing is found and there are no good ideas about that, then I think the next step would be to see a gastroenterologist and have the gastroenterologist again take a very careful history, review all the data from your primary care physician, and then make the decision whether he or she should look down into your stomach with an endoscope.
I heard that there is technology available where you swallow a pill, which may actually be a camera of some type that sends out an electronic signal to provide a scanned image. Is that an effective path to follow, or is that...
It's really cool, isn't it? It's the idea that you can swallow something and then they can...
Is it like a nano
sort of
camera?
Look what's going on. Yeah.
Is that what it is? Okay.
And you're right. There is a technology for that, but it's much too young to pursue that right now. I think in the future, it's really exciting. But I think the if you need to have your stomach and the first part of your small bowel looked at and your esophagus, then I think the way to go up with that is with an endoscope at this point by a very well-trained endoscopist, which would be a gastroenterologist. And remember, again, this idea that we don't know it's your stomach because the intestines are all around there as well. So the doctor may also need to look up from the bottom to take a look at your colon with a colonoscope. So there's lots of stuff that may be done, but please start general because maybe you don't even need that.
Brian, thanks for your call.
Thank you. I had one last question. Someone had suggested that possibly a slight hernia can cause that somewhat constant discomfort. Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility. It would be a less common cause, but it certainly is a possibility.
Okay, Brian, thanks a lot. Let's get to a Facebook question from Michael. Michael asks, why do some non-food smells appear delicious to me, like wanting to eat clay or chalk?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And, you know, I seem to be continuing to say, we're not sure.
Well, you say great question, but, and we're not sure. So.
Right. But first of all, this has been recognized for well over 100 years. That not just the smell, but the taste and texture of some things that are completely inedible for some people have a craving for this. And there are actually names for these things in medical science. And we don't know exactly why that is. There was the idea that some people would eat dirt with the hope of getting, because they're craving iron. But it's really not clear what that's about. From the smell perspective alone, it's really interesting because some people find certain foods just very attractant to them through the smell. And some people find the same foods repellent. We did an article recently on carrageenan, an herb that's used in, for example, a lot of Indian cooking and Asian cooking. Some people absolutely love that smell and taste, and other people think it smells and tastes like soap. There may be a genetic predisposition to that with the carrageenan study, or with the study we found about that. We found that that tended to run in families. So it may be a familial tendency, and that would be another interesting thing to look at.
Dan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you. My question is, could you give us just like four or five five things which, in general, would be good to consider, you know, for good health. For instance, diet and exercise, I feel like would be, you know, up there pretty high at the top. But are there other general things?
Right. Great. Thank you. Sure. I probably could list more than that, but you hit two critical ones. The things you can do for yourself actively are to eat healthfully and to exercise regularly. I don't think there are very many people who would disagree with that statement, and I think most people know that. I think, on the other hand, there are things that we don't need to do. If you're eating healthfully, you probably don't need to take a supplement. There are other things that you should not do, and that is you should not abuse your body. It's the only body we're going to have. And the two biggest abusers of the body in our society, for most people that are legal, are cigarettes and excessive alcohol. The issue with cigarettes, whether it's first-hand smoke, second-hand smoke, or even what we're now calling third-hand smoke, we know is perhaps the greatest risk to the general public's health. So avoiding that at all costs is critical for your health. Just to dilate on that for a moment, I used to have patients come into my office and they'd be worried about what their cholesterol number was and their blood pressure number and their blood sugar number, and they'd be just frantic about those things, and they'd smoke. And all those other things were almost irrelevant compared to the smoking. So that's a big don't. And the other is abuse of alcohol. That's a big topic, but we know that for men, more than two drinks a day, 5 ounces of wine being a drink, and this is for men 65 and under, and for women 65 and under, no more than one drink a day. For people over 65, the advice is no more than one for either male or female. Because we know there are long-term consequences to excessive alcohol. To moderate alcohol, we don't think there are any adverse effects, and there may be some health claims. The other thing that I'd probably add to that list that often people don't think about is polypharmacy. By that, I mean taking lots of different drugs that have been prescribed or you can buy over the counter. Be careful, because drugs are wonderful and they can do wonderful things for us and are critically important, but they can also have a lot of adverse effects, particularly when you're mixing a lot of those. So those are at least some things that come to my mind.
Did you mention exercise?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
Diet and exercise were sort of the
okay, that
the
was at the beginning.
All.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
To be an exception to the supplement, even if you are eating a very healthy diet with plenty of fruits and vegetables, I've read that you still may need a vitamin D supplement. Is that true?
Yeah.
You actually have vitamin D. You refer to that in one of the latest editions.
We did in that supplement that we talked about this summer.
Oh, okay.
To the wellness letter. We think so. I think you're right, but not completely sure. There is clearly a vitamin D bandwagon right now, and there's a lot of good science to support the fact that we perhaps need more than we're getting just from our diet, because it's hard to get enough vitamin D from our diet. And we're thinking that perhaps you need more than that. And the Institute of Medicine, perhaps the most prestigious, well, I think the most prestigious institute that looks at scientific data and makes statements for America's health, came out last year, about a year and a half ago, suggesting that probably 800 international units for most people is a good idea. And it's hard to do that without taking a supplement. The Wellness Letter addressed this in a lead article about a year ago, and we think somewhere between 800 and 1,000 units a day, international units a day, is probably helpful, and there's no evidence that that would be risky. So that's currently where we are, and if you could get it by diet, that would be great, but it's hard to do by diet. So take a look and see what you're eating and see if you're getting that much, and if not, maybe a supplement's in order.
Thank you, Dan.
I'm going to just
go ahead.
Yeah, I want to just add one thing to that, mm-hmm. if that's okay, Ann.
Sure.
we don't have data on 30 years of many millions of people taking supplemental vitamin D and what the consequences of that will be. And that's the one thing that makes me pause about all recommendations. So I'm through with that.
Okay. Dan, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's a chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. You got questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Barbara in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was listening to the woman who has a 22-year-old daughter who has canker sores and now sores on her labia. I've just been through something similar with my daughter, and I just thought perhaps it would help her and maybe some other women in your audience if I gave you some information. It's very possible that it is an overgrowth of candida, which can be caused by yeast, sugar, and simple carbohydrates, which are also converted to sugar. The reason that I was thinking it might be candida is because oral candida is called thrush, which can be very painful, similar to canker sores. And candida is also the cause of yeast infections, overgrowth of yeast. And that's probably why that rice diet worked. So if she can get to a really well-recommended nutritionist, that would probably be her best bet. And it's very likely that it's that simple. And it might take a little while to clear up, though, apparently. That's it.
All right, Barbara. Well, that you know, when you mention the sugar, that might explain my canker sores. But Dr. Swartzberg?
We were talking about this earlier. Mm-hmm. This is the idea that overgrowth of yeast is causing a lot of these kinds of problems. The caller is absolutely right. Overgrowth of yeast in the mouth causes this disease called thrush, which causes these white plaque-like and uncomfortable lesions in the mouth, and most women will experience one or more episodes of yeast infections in the vagina, yeast vaginitis being the most common cause of inflammation in the vagina. There's no question that candida is the most common yeast causes those things. The question really relates to whether feeding people sugar can make this worse. And when one looks for good science to support that statement, we can't find it. That doesn't mean it's not true. It's just that there's no good science to support that statement. And the question of whether an overgrowth or excessive yeast in the intestines causes problems, we just don't know yet. This is an emerging area of really interesting science called the microbiome, and very exciting work, but just much too early to know what all that means. So I guess my bottom line is that if you're getting recurrent yeast infections in the vagina, that there are really good ways to take care of that with some medications your doctor can advise. If you're getting thrush and you're an otherwise healthy adult, you shouldn't be getting that, regardless of whether you're eating excessive sugar or not. And so see your doctor, because there may be something underlying with an immune problem. So I think those are some general comments I would have.
Thank you, Barbara, for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. A tweet from Christina. She asks, are prescription prenatal vitamins better than over-the-counter?
No.
Okay.
There's no evidence that they are. They're better for the person who's selling them.
Okay.
There's no question about that. But the over-the-counter products, in terms of prenatal vitamins, should be fine. Obviously, you want to buy from a reputable company, and I would look for the label that has been certified. For example, USP, the United States Pharmacopeia. It's a private organization, but it does look at those products on a regular basis and make sure that what they claim are in them is there and that they're going to dissolve and be absorbed into your system.
From Susan on Facebook, she asks, does the doctor have any comments on the newest fish oil study that fish oil is overrated? That was just in the paper today, Dr. Swartzberg.
I didn't see the article today, but I think fish oil is... being promoted for more things than there's good science to support. So I'm not surprised to hear that. Where we know that we're talking really about omega-3s, and we know that there's pretty good data in people who have had a heart attack that getting an adequate amount of omega-3 fatty acids in our diet on a regular basis appears to be helpful in preventing another heart attack. And it's hard for people to get perhaps enough omega-3s because the best source, for example, is our fatty fish, and it's hard to get. Most people aren't going to be eating enough fatty fish, so that's where supplements come in.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, for people who have never had a heart attack, there's no good evidence that we have to be taking supplemental omega-3s at all. And I think that's where there have been a lot of claims made in health food stores and a lot of promotion on the internet about omega-3s and how helpful they are and that everybody should be taking them. And there's nothing that I know of in good, solid science to support that for a public health policy.
We only have a few minutes left, but I thought it was interesting in Wellness Made Easy from the, let's see, which one is it? I think it's this month. That you talk about flushing unwanted medicines down the drain or toilet, and you recommend not doing that because of the environmental impact, but that there are exceptions.
Well, there are. With some drugs, for example, with the narcotics, sometimes that's your only recourse. The ideal thing to do, we wrote this article, and I remember we had an extensive discussion about it in the with the editorial board. The best thing is that you want to try to find a place you can take them. Often pharmacies will take them from you, but if you can find an organization that will take them that's reputable, that's probably the best thing. If you cannot, then the next best thing may be to put them down the toilet, but that's just getting into our water supply, mm-hmm. and it's not ideal. So the bottom line is try to find a pharmacy that will take old drugs from you.
And then one thing that I thought was kind of strange, we have about a minute left, cool hands can make exercising easier.
Yeah, I thought that was really strange, too. So did a lot of people on our editorial board.
I can do
board.
That.
But, you know, we looked at the paper, and we were really skeptical, and the paper was well done. The study was well done. And so the answer is yes, it might allow you to exercise a little more because it does seem to cool your body down a little bit, which is critical in terms of being able to exercise. Now, that said, how important is that for the average exerciser?
Uh-huh.
Probably not
okay.
very.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, thanks for joining us today. It was fun.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, too.
Dr. John Swartzberg, professor and chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley's Wellness Letter. Thanks to the Allsides staff, associate producer Amy Jurevich, Allsides assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins, and volunteer Rose Joe. Thanks for listening. This is Allsides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.